Good morning, everyone. I'm Asha Nayaswamy, and we're continuing our conversations. And today is the second half of yesterday. Yesterday, we were talking why blue, which is about the Nayaswamy order. I just realized just before I started that this is not quite the right color. Not every blue outfit I have is exactly the right color, and I meant to dress appropriate for you today, but I forgot. So forgive me, and we will go on. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Beloved Master Paramhansa Yogananda, Saints of all religions, dearest friend Swami Kriyananda, humbly we bow to you all. Help us to attune ourselves to your great vision for humanity and to your individual call to each one of us to expand our consciousness, to raise our vibration, that we may live in the joy which is our birthright. We are your children. Guide us and inspire us, that we may find our home in thee. Om. Peace. Amen. I was looking through this book, A Renunciate Order for the New Age, and yesterday I talked a lot about the inception of this book, how Swami came to write it. This is a really extraordinarily deep and interesting book, and it's honestly, it's too deep for the 30-minute programs that I'm doing today. So I'm going to just encourage you to go. There's a website based on, you can find it. It's something like A Renunciate Order for a New Age. You can order this book. I really encourage you to do it. It's a very serious book. This is not a book for people who are not willing to face into the totality of what the spiritual path really can be. It's also kind, because everything Swami does is kind. But it sets a very high bar, but it's fascinating for those who are really wanting a clear description of what real renunciation can be. And Swami goes into great length talking about the flaws in the present ways that renunciation is expressed both East and West. In the East, there is an inclination to think the monastic life is the true spiritual life and that householders are, by definition, compromising. And as Swamiji says, this can lead to arrogance. And in the West, there's a tendency to, as I said yesterday, to try to overcome the ego by suppressing it, which is in itself can be very unhealthy. And it just isn't the spirit of Dwapar Yuga. We're just in a new age and new realities are needed. But what I'm going to talk about today is just more in a general way, sort of what the Nayaswamy order is and why it was created. I talked a little about how it came to be created, but why it was created and what the future of it is. And then what I will do probably in the next 2 days is there are four vows associated with the Nayaswamy order, and I'll talk about those vows and use that as a way to describe it and let you go into the pages of this book. If I were doing a month-long study course, that's what this book is about. Maybe someday I will. So let me go on a little bit. There's a few things that first need to be understood. And I know Ananda has become just a little bit complex in its organization. And that's unfortunate because it used to not be. And in fact, the Nayaswamy order itself has created an impression of Ananda that is in itself unfortunate. So let me say a little bit more. The Nayaswamy order has originated from Ananda, because that's where the devotees were. That's almost everyone, not quite, but almost everyone who's taken initiation has been associated with Ananda, especially starting in 2009 when the entire thing was launched. But it actually, in fact, has nothing to do with Ananda. In fact, toward the end of this book, Swami laments the fact that he's very afraid that the Nayaswamy order will just get sucked into Ananda. And then, as he said, then we'll become subject to all the flaws of institutionalism, which is the exact opposite of what he's trying to create. What Swami is doing here is completely independent of Ananda. There, many centuries ago, a very great saint called Adi Shankaracharya, Adi means first, Swami Shankaracharya, he reformed the existing Swami order in India and gave it the form that has been followed in modern times, as in the times that we remember. In Autobiography of a Yogi, Master has a long description about what these what Shankaracharya did, how it was organized, how there are these different divisions of the Swami order, each of them relating to an aspect of nature. I actually drew some interesting parallels in Light Bearer between some of the things that Swami did in terms of attunement with nature and what was done in the Swami order. But each Swami in the order is not only part of the whole order, but is part of one of these subsets. Yogananda was part of the Giri subset, which means the mountains. And so anyone that was initiated through Yogananda's lineage, which included Swami Kriyananda until he shifted to Nayaswami, he was part of the Giri order. There's the Saraswati order. There's the forest, the land, the sea. And so each Swami would be part of this. There were many rules that were associated with being a Swami. And one of the things that Kriyananda talks about in here is how so many of those rules were designed for a time that simply doesn't exist anymore. Swami would never stay more than 3 days in any one place. He would always travel on foot. He would never carry money. He would not own property. Just all these things that, and he would live by begging. And it's just none of that is practical nowadays. And so many of those rules are honored in the breach, but it just confuses things because everything has changed. The divisions were partly in place because India was such a large country and travel was so difficult that there needed to be kind of a local government. You couldn't have it governed all completely. But now with email and Zoom, you know, the whole world is one place and just everything has changed. And Swami had been concerned about this for a very long time, just concerned about the state of renunciation in the world now. And he kept wanting to create another way of understanding renunciation, but he said the flaw that he kept running into and that stopped him for many years is that when he looked at the community that he himself had developed, which is Ananda, the majority... He started a formal renunciate order in the 70s, in the early years. But he said he knew it could never succeed because the demands of community life caused men and women to mix very freely. And it was just completely impractical to isolate men and women from each other. And so naturally, they became attracted to each other. And in the end, more or less, the monastery dissolved and many of those who had been living as renunciates became married couples. Again, I talk about this in Light Bearer, and it was a very important positive development for Ananda itself for reasons that I described. We had become a little bit false in our spirituality. It had become a bit intellectual. The monastery had grown to be like a third of the community, or 60 people were there, but too many of them were there because they felt they ought to be there. If I'm serious spiritually, I will be a renunciate, therefore I'll join the monastery. It wasn't, I feel in my heart that this makes me feel free and happy. It was, this is what I ought to do. And Swami became very concerned about that trend because that's the worst thing that happens in spiritual organizations is that people start deciding what they should be from the outside in instead of from the inside out. And eventually it just, for various reasons, it just fell apart. Swami himself got married. We just changed the community into a householder community. So then over the decades since then, Swami said every time he thought about initiating others as Swamis, which he had a perfect right to do after his period as a householder was over and he resumed his position as a Swami, but he said the most dedicated people that were all around him, almost all of them were married. And the tradition of the Swami order was to be single renunciates. And he couldn't get past that. Because suddenly you're making a different group of people, swamis, which has a certain status, but it doesn't, it's not necessarily a true reflection of the magnetic leadership of the community. And what happened finally, and I think it happened on that day in Assisi, which was in June of 2009, when Swami had the miracle healing and just stood up and wrote the book, he just realized that we would simply have married swamis. It was as simple as that. And once he sort of was over that hurdle, the rest of it was obvious. That night, that very night, when there was a meeting of maybe 8 or 10 people who, it was all the people who lived in Assisi, plus me, because I happened to be there, a couple of us who happened to be there from America. And one of the women, who is a founding member of Ananda, but has been married for 40 years, she said to Swami very quietly, "Do we have to renounce our spouses to become swamis?" And Swami very sweetly said back, "I don't see why that would be necessary," just like that. And then it began. Naya simply means new. So the Naya Swami order is simply the new Swami order. But Swami's intention in this was that it was a universal order, and he specifically talks about how he above all does not wish it to become rule-bound and institutionalized and guided by authority. He feels that the very nature of a renunciate is that it's between you and God, and that he's trying to move it out of this structured monasticism in which the needs of the institution become bigger. So on that June afternoon when Swami was talking about the order that very day, within half an hour, Swami was talking about what we would wear and what colors we would wear. Because traditionally, when you take a serious renunciate vow, it tends to show. And it traditionally tends to show what they call the habit, what you wear. And habit is an interesting word with a dual meaning, your habit. It becomes your habit. And you separate yourself out from society as a whole, and you're recognizably something else. It's a protection. It's an affirmation, and it's also a protection, because you're walking around with your commitment self-evident, and it helps discipline you as well as setting an example. Now, one of the things about Ananda that has always, up till that point, has always been one of the wonderfully marvelous aspects of it, is that there were no visible signs of authority. Swamiji himself set the example by that. He rarely wore orange because, as I said yesterday, he didn't particularly like the color. And also, I think he didn't wear it because he didn't want to emphasize his authority externally. He wanted whatever respect and authority people gave him to be a genuine, intuitive, and spontaneous offering from the individual, not an institutional norm. And in fact, for many years at Ananda, there was very little ceremony around Swamiji. He just came and went in a very natural and ordinary way, and he liked it like that. It was only in the late 90s when he began to live in Europe, and his phase of life changed also, I have to say. And the Italians especially, who are very devotional by nature and understand saints, they began to respond to Swami spontaneously and naturally in a very different way than the Americans did. Whenever he would come into a room, they would stand up. Whenever he would leave, they would stand up. And they just treated him with a spontaneous reverence that really came from their hearts that we had never considered. And when we saw that, it suddenly felt appropriate. And then Ananda in America began to shift. And of course, when Swami went to India in 2003, I mean, there's a tradition in India that you don't even sit at the same level as the teacher. So if you're in the living room and he's sitting in a chair, everyone else sits on the floor, and the Americans would just lounge on the couch next to him. And, you know, the Indians were more or less horrified by the way that we expressed ourselves and the tradition of touching the teacher's feet when you enter and when you leave. None of that was part of the Ananda culture, and Swami really liked it that way. He also realized that he couldn't fight against the Italian temperament, and he certainly couldn't fight against the Indian tradition. It just would not have been understood, and there was no point in it, because it was real to them. They felt grossly inappropriate if they didn't follow those rules. And it was a true intuitive perception. It wasn't an institutional norm. So now when we're going to be, and I'm going to fast forward from June to November, when Swami did the first initiation for the Nyaswami Order himself. He did it in Assisi. About 12 of us came over from America, and a few people came from India. A few Americans came from India for that first initiation. And the morning after the initiation, we sat with Swamiji. And by that time, we had been working on a blue outfit. I apologize for this color. I don't know how it comes across on the screen, but it's a darker color. It's not as bright a blue as I was wearing yesterday. There's an actual base color, which we call Nyaswami blue, which interesting, in the color charts, the name of that color is blue. All the other colors are royal blue, turquoise blue, sea blue. You know, there's lots of variations, but whenever we actually get the exact shade that we determined was Nyaswami blue, it's called blue. But it's impractical. We know we have to just get clothes where we can get them. So the joke is, if it's blue, it will do. But there's still a set point that I was wearing yesterday. Now, coming into this, the morning after the initiation, we sat with Swamiji and we started talking about what are we going to do. And one of the issues that was discussed at great length, and it was a nuanced discussion. These things are not obvious. As someone said, we've spent all this time trying to fit in. And because there was this discussion that we would wear, not only would we wear blue, but the original discussion is that we would have a robe, like a long kurta top and a pair of loose trousers. And there was a prototype of it, which we had at that time, which at least in Palo Alto is what the light bearers still wear. It's a particular pattern. It's not at all important. The main thing is it's a long tunic and a pair of trousers, unisex. Everyone would wear it. A woman can wear it and it looks a little bit, whimsical for fashion. It looks a little bit like what Indian women often wear. When a man wears it, it's clearly a religious garb. It just doesn't look like anything that a man would wear. And originally Swami talked about we could wear this all the time, which of course, if you're walking down the streets of Palo Alto or San Francisco or in an airport, you know, you stand out. You look like a Franciscan monk or Catholic priest or the Archbishop of somewhere. You know, it's just not normal. So someone said, we've spent all this time trying to blend in. And all of a sudden, you know, you're trying to make us stand out. And Swami's comment was very interesting. He said, well, maybe it is time to stand out. He said, maybe it's time to set a serious example of what real spiritual dedication looks like. And so it went back and forth. But very interestingly, every single question that was asked of Swamiji about behavior beyond the fundamentals, because he articulates in here what's expected of a Nyaswami. There were other vows taken on that November, but this discussion was just the Nyaswami's. Every question, I mean, the women had a lot of questions. Should I continue to dye my hair? Should I wear jewelry? Should we still wear makeup? You know, just like women's questions. The men, do I have to wear this outfit all the time? If I'm going to the grocery store, do I have to dress like this? Every question that was asked, Swami would sometimes express a slight opinion. Often he would express no opinion. He would say, do as you feel. Because he felt it was extremely important that we understand from the beginning that this is not us being obedient to rules that are laid down by others. This is our relationship with God, our vow, our commitment, and our decision as to how we're going to express it. And no one is there to say you're doing it right, you're doing it wrong. And even though we spend an enormous amount of energy getting the color just right, although I may tell you the color was actually an accident. I was working with it here in this area, and the color that we had sort of chosen was more like periwinkle. And there was a place that would dye fabric exactly. And I had used them various times to dye Swami's orange robes and to dye other things. And you could take to that man, you know, a sample of anything. and you would say, dye it to this color, and he would dye it to that color. So I took this prototype of the robe to him, and I took the periwinkle color, and he returned what became Nyaswami blue. And it's the only time in all the time I used him, he was very expensive and very good, that he ever missed the color. He totally missed the color. He totally missed the color we gave him and gave us back a color we liked much better because we had had no sample of that color. Just that was just the way it had worked out. But anyway, we worked out the color and the style and all of this. And then after it was all done, I was actually in India with Swamiji. There were four of us with him. And we were having tea on the, this was before he'd moved to India. So I think it was the same year. Might have been January of 2010. It was right at the same time. After I personally had spent hundreds of hours and actually quite a lot of money getting the pattern and the color just right. We're having tea and Swami says, looking over the sunset in Goa at the ocean, he says, in Italy, you know, with the influence of the Catholics there, it seemed important to me that we have a set robe and a set color. But in India, I see it's completely unnecessary. I think, oh, Lord, I've spent so much time on this now. And I said, sir, maybe we can establish a base. And then, of course, people will vary from it. But if we have a starting point, at least we'll have a point of reference. And he saw that that was a valid point, and he also saw how I was responding. And then I made the others at the table swear to secrecy, at least for a couple of years, until we were sort of on the go. And I actually think it's a good idea, because now there is a base point. If you want to make something Nyaswami blue, you know what it is. Okay, but having said all of that, Swami's entire point was that it was personal. Now let me just think what the rest of that was. And that it was unfortunate that it appeared to be an Ananda order. And it was unfortunate, and I have to just simply say I still lament it, that since the Nyaswami order came in and people wear, it's mainly the blue that shows, where there's a few brahmacharis, so there's also yellow. But there were a lot of people who became Nyaswamis in that first wave, because there was a huge buildup of very experienced, deep devotees who were looking for their next step. When Swami asked me, I was around 60 at that point. And 60 is an important transition astrologically. And I also could see, I sort of saw myself as entering the period of time from 60 to 80, when a woman becomes older, when just everything begins to shift. And I had been spending quite a lot of time thinking about how I was going to live that last 20 years because, you know, the 40 years prior to that time of my spiritual life had been exceedingly creative and dynamic, and I did not want to lose energy at the end. I also had thought, just as a female person, because I had really worked hard to blend in. I had to learn. I'm not a natural female, and I had to learn how to dress, how to look, how to do my hair, how to wear earrings, and I was noticing that some older women lose their magnetism, some keep their magnetism, and I was trying to figure out who to be. What kind of an older woman am I going to be? And I was worried about it. I was seriously thinking about it all. So when Swami introduced the Swami order in June, back in June, he said, what do you think? I said, sir, I think that you are rescuing me from spiritual mediocrity. And he was very serious. He said, yes, just like that. So it was like all of a sudden I knew who to be. I knew how this period of time has been and would be defined. So there was this huge backlog of people like me who were just ready for some next big step. So suddenly within the community, there's a lot of Swamis. And there's still this natural regard, and there should be natural regard for spiritual authority or for respect for experience, respect for age. But the power of Ananda has always been that no one influences by position. People may have position, but position does not give you authority. In fact, Ananda people are exceedingly clever at getting around people's position. Years ago, I was working in a certain business, and there was this one woman who did not have the magnetism for people to listen to her. Even though she was quite capable, she didn't have the magnetism for people to listen to her. It was a very complicated karma that she had, where she could just never have power, even though she wanted it. She wanted me to make rules so that people had to listen to her. I told her, I said, look, I've lived at Ananda already 10 years or something. I promise you, I can make all the rules in the world. If they don't want your opinion, they're going to figure a way to get around you. They just will, because Ananda is not an institution, and we don't run by position. We've always run by magnetism and by the willingness to take responsibility. And what you're called really makes no difference at all. If you have the magnetism, and if you'll take responsibility, you have position, whether you have a title or not, zero. But now all of a sudden, there's all these people in blue, and there's just this natural inclination that we have defined a certain caste and class within Ananda that we never had before. And people coming in suddenly see people walking around in different colors. And it's not merely that you're wearing blue, but to a certain extent, well, it's more for women than for men, but some men also dress in this style. But it just shows you're not doing the same thing you were doing yesterday. Swamiji accepts the fact that nothing lasts forever and things have to change. And it was that the Nyaswami order itself for the future of Dwapara Yuga, and I'm probably not going to have time to finish this thought, so I'll have to start it tomorrow. For the future of Dwapara Yuga was too important, and Ananda was the place from which it could be launched, and therefore it was the necessary gathering of the forces to make it happen. But coincidentally right now, the Nyaswami order looks like an Ananda entity, but the expectation, indeed the sincere prayer and intention of Swamiji in doing it, was that it will simply be the new Swami order, which encompasses all paths, all countries, and Ananda would just be one little part of it, like that. So within our community, and also the reality, you know, just creating the affirming, and this is the very positive part of it, affirming within the context of Ananda, but within the context of the whole world, that marriage is not a detriment to spiritual life. It is true that the Nyaswami vow is a vow of celibacy. So that does affect the way Westerners especially think about marriage. And all of that is discussed beautifully and extremely subtly in this book. But again, it's probably too much for this conversation. So there is a change in that respect. But nonetheless, there has been this sort of built-in bias that to have a personal relationship, to raise a family, to be a householder, inherently means that you've fallen. And in Autobiography of a Yogi, the original Autobiography of a Yogi, Master says that, in fact, the householder path is the higher path if you can maintain a certain mental detachment. In later editions of Autobiography of a Yogi, those words were shifted. And they were shifted because there was conflict between the monastic and the householders in the organization that was publishing Autobiography of a Yogi. And that paragraph of Master's words did not serve the cause of the monastics, so they neutralized it, which is unfortunate, which is why I always recommend that you read the blue version of Autobiography of a Yogi, because it's the original unedited version. Okay, so one thing, though, that the Nyaswami order did for Ananda, which is extremely positive, is that it erased the idea of higher or lower. But nonetheless, as someone wrote to me yesterday after hearing this first class, the bar at Ananda was already pretty high, and now it just got a little higher. Well, the bar for the spiritual path is infinite, and it just keeps going up until we achieve infinity. So yes, that is an issue. But that is, in fact, one of the most challenging parts of the spiritual path, is to be able to realize how high the mountain is, to be able to honestly say where, not only where one stands on the mountain, but where one feels comfortable on the mountain. and not feel unworthy, less, disappointed, like a failure, envious, jealous, insecure, but just simply be at peace. I am what I am before my conscience and God. Do as you feel. That's a vital part of the spiritual life. Well, my friends, I've reached the end of the time without reaching the end of the subject. So we're going to have to do Why Blue Part 3 tomorrow before I get to the vows. God bless you.